Hi everyone, this is Daniel Strauss here with Betsy Woodruff on another episode of Woodruff and Strauss. We're recording well, and it's been a long second day back in 2015. But here we are. Special thanks to Jim Newell and Patrick.
Patrick Brennan.
For
I know you know it.
Yeah, for minding the shop while we were gone, and we did notice. The first comment on that was that they did a better job than us. So thanks, Blogging Heads commenters. Real nice.
We'll try harder.
Yeah, try harder. We're going to try harder in 2015.
Jesus. We see you, Jim and Patrick.
So today, Betsy, we are on the eve. Like clockwork, we start a new year and... First thing that happens in a new year in Congress these days is someone votes against House Speaker John Boehner for Speaker.
New year, new Speaker of the House.
New year, new Speaker of the House. No.
Maybe. Could have happened.
There were a few names that came out, and I think as we speak, the reports are coming out that they're losing their committee assignments. Who saw that coming? So it was Dan Webster, Ted Yoho, and Louis Gohmert.
Yes.
A Tea Party darling named Jim Bridenstine, who is the heartthrob of the hard right, nominated Gohmert, and I think
a heartthrob. One of a number.
Right. I had, you know, by the way, on Bridenstine, my personal bet was that he was going to run for Tom Coburn's seat and probably win. He did not. Mm-hmm. He did not run. Interesting. But I mean, that was it. So
I have a question for you on this, Daniel. Yeah. When Republicans talk about the grievances that they have about Speaker Boehner, what sticks out to you? Because I cover this, you know, as somebody from, you know, a background in conservative media. There are conservative figures I follow whose opinions I pay attention to, you know, when I'm figuring out why are these people mad? Why are they going after him? I'm curious what your sense is of why... The Tea Party is so miffed at the Speaker.
I mean, every time you hear that, you hear criticism of Boehner from my point of view, it's always Boehner is pro-immigration reform. He doesn't respect Congress. Some of it is really vague. Some of it is just like he doesn't uphold order in the chamber. But the sense I've always gotten is that the feeling is that he's not going hard enough on Obama.
Mm-hmm.
He's not fighting Obamacare or amnesty and immigration reform enough. He's not, I don't know, he's just not, the view, as I understand it, is that he's just not leading the chamber in a way that's satisfactory. I mean, but part of it, I the sense I get, it, part of it is they just want one of their own. And, you know, the over break, and we should definitely talk about this too, the highest-ranking Tea Party Republican got into some trouble. And frankly, that, you know, Steve Scalise. And that didn't seem to save him. But back to Boehner. But let's get to Scalise in a little bit. I mean, that's the sense that I always get. What is your sense on this?
Yeah.
And he just represents the establishment, I guess. Is that that's his alignment?
I think there's a certain contingent of conservatives that are going to dislike Boehner even if he, you know, tossed pocket constitutions in the air while waving a Gadsden flag and singing a song about Sarah Palin. Like, I think no matter what, Boehner will never be conservative enough for them. And I understand some of the, you know, some of the snark and Twitter derision that you see for those folks. I think, however, it's interesting that this time what seemed to really set off frustration with Boehner was the passage of the Cromnibus. And, you know, from what I can tell, a huge number of members of Congress had totally legitimate grievances, both with the content of that legislation and with the way it came together.
Mm-hmm.
The Speaker put it together, gave people, less than 48 hours to read legislation that was about 1,600 pages long, which was a direct violation of a pledge that House leadership, including the Speaker, made in 2010. The legislation included tons of provisions that had nothing to do with keeping the government open, which is also in violation of the 2010 pledge. And obviously, you know, we talked about this earlier. There were reasons that progressive Democrats had for opposing it involving Wall Street and campaign finance. And then, of course, many Tea Party members on the right opposed it because it didn't do, they thought it didn't do enough to stop the president's immigration action. So I think when people talk about conservative frustration with Boehner, it's important to keep that piece of legislation in mind because, in my opinion, I don't think we would have seen nearly the showing that we saw today if the Cromnibus situation hadn't gone the way it had. And
really? So that, you think that
I
was
think
what...
So, yeah. I think so.
I mean, is it just the fear that Boehner ushers through too many massive bills and is just, you know, not willing to do the piecemeal approach that the hard right seems to want on everything from immigration reform to, I don't know, just everything else. They always want... hard right Republicans always want smaller bills and more time to look at them.
I think
that doesn't sound that bad. It makes a lot of sense to me, frankly.
What? You don't want 1,000-page bills that will be like 12 hours to read them? What's wrong with you guys?
I mean, that's how...
You bunch of Tea Party fanatics.
I think there's I actually think there's a case for this. Right now in TPM, we have a piece up based off of which AARP is crowing about Republicans trying
crowing,
to...
Good crowing or bad crowing?
They are agreeing with Democrats on this. So they about a provision in a legislative maneuver to try and roll back Social Security's stuff, and that's like one of their earliest very tacit moves in Congress. And it's the same with Democrats in Wall Street, right? With this Dodd-Frank provision that Elizabeth Warren really wanted to or fought hard to get out and lost on, right? These were provisions that were snuck in there, and it's hard. I mean, like, isn't there a case for that? As much as the left criticizes Tea Partiers on everything,
So when it actually comes to not the content of legislation, but the way these policies are changed, the left and the far left and the far right have often identical grievances.
Right.
I think it's extremely unfair for people in the media and for leaders in Congress to poo-poo those grievances and act like they're not serious.
But at the same time, how do you get everyone to come to the table, right?
Well, I think what's important about the sort of the Tea Party rights efforts to push out Speaker Boehner is that it's kind of their way of flexing, right? It's their way of showing we're here, you need our votes. And we're going to try to push you as far as we can to the right. I mean, that's what they should be doing. That's what they were elected to do. If you're a conservative member of Congress, your goal is to push Boehner as far to the right as possible. And they do that by vocally criticizing him. They do that by not voting for him for speaker, giving him a little bit of a scare. They do that by not voting for his legislation. They do that by going after him all the time. Like, I think what you have to remember is that this stuff works. At the end of the day, Boehner is probably a more conservative Speaker of the House than he would be if there weren't these 25 to 30 to 40, give or take, members of his caucus who think he is, I don't know, Bill Clinton light. I think big picture, the Tea Party has had a decent amount of success, and they can't say they're happy with Boehner because then they can't really, you know, use the stick rather than the carrot, but I think people perhaps underestimate the influence that they have.
I mean, let me ask you though, related to that, none of these guys—Gohmert, Ted Yoho, and Dan Webster—I guess Dan Webster was the most serious of the bunch. But like, none of these guys are particularly serious challengers.
The point also though is that it didn't really matter who the challenger was. The point wasn't that the vote was not for someone. The vote was against Boehner.
Mm-hmm.
They could have all 25 of them could have voted for Senator Rand Paul, and
Ted
it would
Cruz,
have had the same effect.
Right?
They all could have, right, exactly. Like, Dan Webster was not going to become Speaker of the House. It's interesting that he got 12 votes, especially given that people weren't even really talking about him until yesterday. But that wasn't going to happen. And for people who don't know who Dan Webster is, unbelievable, you wouldn't know some random Florida congressman. Dan Webster was a former Speaker of the House in the state of Florida, and he is loved by the Tea Party, but he is certainly not a firebrand. You know, he's not somebody who waves his arms over his head. He's not on Fox or on Glenn Beck yelling. He writes the Metro. I met him on the metro one time. Yeah, yeah, I did. Yeah. You know, a very even keel, you know, serious person. So it was interesting that he emerged as the member of Congress to get, you know, 12 of the so 24 House Republicans specifically voted for a person who's not Boehner. A 25th voted present. Of the 24 who voted for someone other than Boehner, 12 voted for Daniel Webster. It's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that's good. But and this was a protest vote. And I guess, I mean, what I saw today is that this was more serious than last year. Do you think we're going to see that again?
I mean, it sounds definitely
like there was a website, there was hype about this, there was explanations about this. It seems like this was taken a little more seriously than last year.
I would think definitely. And the reason I think that is because they were better at it this year than they were last year. It obviously didn't work.
Yeah, still nowhere near as close.
It could have been. So they would have needed, was the number 29 if Democrats hadn't left the Cuomo funeral? So, obviously, Mario Cuomo passed away, and a number of Democrats weren't present today for the vote because they were at his funeral. If those Democrats had been present, then Boehner would have needed to get more Republican votes to get half of the members present. So if those Democrats had been there, then Boehner would have needed to get 29 Republican votes, or could only have lost at least 29 Republican votes. He lost 25. So let's say the Cuomo funeral was, you know, a couple days earlier. If that happened, Boehner was only 4 or 5 votes away from a second round of voting. That's extremely close. I mean, we're talking if you have an extra day of these Tea Party guys calling each other. We're talking if the Tea Party guys have a slightly more professional whipping operation, that you're in a second round of voting really easy. This was a close vote. It was not guaranteed that it was going to go out the way that Boehner would have wanted it to. I mean, 5 votes. And that's not even to mention the fact that there were 3 freshmen newly elected, Barry Loudermilk from Georgia, John Radcliffe from Texas, and Alex Mooney from West Virginia.
They all voted for
Speaker Boehner.
Yeah.
But they also all signed a pledge of the Madison Project saying they would vote against current leadership as soon as possible. So Madison Project is mad at them for violating their pledge. Next time around, they're going to need to vote against Boehner because of this pledge that they signed. That's 3 more. I know people talked about how it was going to be easier for Boehner to keep his caucus under control because it's larger now, but 25 is a ton. And those are the hardliners. You know, those are the guys that are upset. You had a number of people who really don't like Boehner who still voted for him. John Fleming, who's a firebrand on immigration. Mo Brooks, who's a firebrand on immigration.
So what is it?
Matt Salmon, who has extremely harsh things to say about the speaker. All those guys voted for Boehner to be speaker. So if we have a slightly more professional operation, if these guys are a little more strategic about it, if they know what they're doing better, you know, you change a couple factors and we would have had chaos today.
So I'm wondering a little bit, what do you expect Boehner? I mean, it sounds like a lot of these guys are hardliners on immigration. What do you think would be something that we're going to see this time around? Because it got closer than last time with Boehner on this.
What specific policy do I think would be different?
Is he not gonna work with Obama? I guess on like Keystone. That was something that came up today.
I don't think Keystone's an issue. But I think Boehner's. Well, a lot of these guys are going to lose committee seats, I think.
They're losing them right now. I mean, they're getting their notices as we tape this.
Wow. That's amazing.
So.
Right. So that's happening. But I think, I don't know. I don't know if I can think of a specific policy issue, but I'm confident this was nerve-wracking for the speaker. And it's these Tea Party guys' way of saying to the speaker, you need us. You're going to need us on close votes. So you're either going to need to court us or you're going to need to start talking with Pelosi and Hoyer a lot more.
Which could happen. Nancy Pelosi in the minority, all she wants to do is mess with Republican leadership. That is all she's going to do. And her minority is small now. So all they want to do is just screw around with Republicans whenever they can, because otherwise it's just kind of boring.
She must be having so much fun.
I guess. I don't know. Probably. Related to this, though, over the break, in the black spot between when Jim and Pat taped their episode and now with us, Steve Scalise fell into the spotlight in what I think some might call an inopportune manner. He was right, and the importance about Scalise is that he's the new Tea Party whip, and he's the idea of the idea that he would be whip is that
he's the red state Republican on leadership.
Red state Southern Republican.
For people who don't follow this stuff closely, there are three top House Republicans. You've got Speaker of the House John Boehner, who is a moderate Republican from Ohio. Mm-hmm. You've got Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who is an even more moderate Republican from California, and you have Majority Whip Steve Scalise, who is more conservative, although Tea Party conservatives would still have been critical of him regardless, and who's from Louisiana. So Steve Scalise is the only red state Republican in House leadership. That's significant to the caucus. Before him, the top three were Boehner, Cantor, McCarthy. Cantor is from Virginia, which honestly is a purple state, if not almost a blue state. So Scalise is the first red state Republican in leadership in a really long time. It's definitely first Southern Republican in leadership.
And he got caught, news broke by a liberal blogger and then spread like wildfire because too many reporters, me included, were sick and tired of hanging around at home and wanted to just get back into the throes of things. News broke that way back when Steve Scalise delivered a speech to a white supremacist group.
Yes. So what happened was, Stormfront is this horrible, evil hate forum of neo-Nazis and white supremacists where they, I guess, I'm not a Stormfront regular user, not an expert, but they get together and, yeah, I know, I'm not a Stormfront expert, I'm just, full disclosure, these guys get together and, you know, talk on forums about all their neo-Nazi white supremacist stuff. And in 2002, I guess, a Stormfront member put up a post saying Steve Scalise spoke at our white supremacist conference in Louisiana. He was so great. All the white supremacists love Steve Scalise. He gave a speech to us. It was awesome. And now this is a person whose account is no longer active. Nobody knows who actually did this post. No other Stormfront members said, oh yeah, that speech was awesome. This is based on two posts that one Stormfront user put up like 10 or 12 years ago, and his account is inactive. Now, these posts got picked up by a liberal blog because I don't think any serious media outlet would go through Stormfront and say, oh, here's a random post from a person whose name we can't verify, who we know nothing about, let's do a story on it, right? No reporter in their right mind would write that story, and justifiably so.
Bloggers are powerful, man.
So a blogger put this up, and then reporters saw the blog post and asked Scalise about it. Costa, who's a reporter at Washington Post, yep, Steve Scalise spoke to the white supremacist conference. It boggles my mind that Steve Scalise's people immediately confirmed this.
Well, they,
if I had been Steve Scalise's people, I would have said, why are you asking me about Stormfront? Stormfront is evil. We know nothing about that. End of story. It's not a story. The fact that Steve Scalise's people immediately confirmed it is either a sign of just endearing and laudable candor or total flack incompetence.
I mean, you know, we don't know how he was approached about this question. Maybe Costa pitched it in the way that was sort of like, I mean, called his bluff or something. I don't know, man. It was Costa who broke that?
Someone from Politico asked Scalise, and he said he didn't remember. And then an anonymous Scalise aide told Costa that Scalise was there.
Okay.
That's how I recall it happening.
Wow.
I remember there being a Politico story, and the headline was, Scalise doesn't remember if he spoke at a white supremacist conference. And then...
So it picked up, and what followed was a bunch of interviews with big name in political nerd circles. And you interviewed one of them. You interviewed David Duke.
No, I interviewed David Duke.
Kenny Knight.
Yes.
Kenny Knight. David Duke's right-hand man, I guess you could say. I think Duke, was it Duke or Knight who talked to Costa and said, we didn't really talk about the Jewish question or or politics.
Yeah, David Duke. I didn't talk to David Duke, but Costa talked to David Duke.
Yeah, I think it was.
So anyway, it's a disaster. Kenny Knight changed his story. At one point, he said Scalise spoke at the conference. At another point, he said Scalise spoke at a neighborhood meeting before the conference in the same room as the conference that Kenny Knight invited it to.
10 a.m. to 11, neighborhood conference. 11 a.m. to 3, white supremacy.
Listen.
Right? Right? Just, I mean, it could happen.
It could happen. I don't know. It was 12 years ago. Obviously.
Commercial space, cheap commercial space is difficult to come by.
Let's pretend that Kenny Knight's changed story that he spoke at a neighborhood association group. Let's pretend that was totally true.
Okay.
That's still a really big problem for Scalise because he took an invitation from a guy who was the known right-hand man of David Duke and who himself was almost certainly a really, really horrible white supremacist. Like, there's pictures of Kenny Knight in front of massive Confederate flags. Kenny Knight is not like a nice neighbor. Kenny Knight is a white supremacist who's David Duke's top ally. Mm-hmm. If Kenny Knight invites you to speak at something, you say, no, thank you. I'm going the opposite direction. Regardless, even best case scenario, even taking the most charitable, generous, humanly possible interpretation of this, it still was extremely poor judgment. That said, a big Cedric Richmond, who is an African-American Democrat from Louisiana,
yep,
immediately went to bat for Scalise, said...
Edwin Scalise, Edwards, too, the infamous Democratic governor and congressman also went to bat for him. Right.
Yeah. And it seems like both Democrats and Republicans deferred to Richmond and said, you know, like, Richmond's on this guy's side. We're not going to go after him for it. Which makes sense to me.
Let's not give the Democrats too much credit here. They were pretty...
House Democrats,
Pelosi's office was quick to be like,
they criticized.
He's got to resign or something.
I don't think Pelosi said he had to resign.
I
think there was only one House Democrat who called for Scalise to step down. Let's Google it.
Okay. Let's see who's faster now, on the Google.
Democrats said, I could be wrong. So, yeah. So first House Democrat calls for Scalise to resign from GOP. And this is not Pelosi. This is a story from The Hill. Hang on one sec.
Okay, no, but she... But
yeah, she didn't... They were critical. They were very critical. They said this was stupid. He shouldn't have done this. This is bad. But I only didn't call for him to step down.
My mistake, sorry. You're right, because she... Important, around this time, Pelosi was also calling for Boehner to call for Michael Grimm to resign.
Right.
In an unrelated manner. My confusion.
So I think, by my count, only one Democrat called for Scalise to step down.
Right. So that's actually pretty remarkable. All of that was that Boehner, too, was actually fairly quick to say that he, you know, Scalise is a trusted friend and, mm-hmm. you know, he's going through a good time. And he said something like his character is strong or something like that.
Yeah, so it's interesting that
It's hard for me, Betsy, to not think that Boehner was also calculating that he's got the speaker vote coming up and, like, you know, just don't want to get cantered or something. So,
you know, although I think it backfired for him though.
Yeah.
If that was his intent, because the Tea Party people were really upset about Scalise. I mean, Tea Party folks are calling for Scalise to step down. Sarah Palin, Mark Levin, who's a really influential radio show host. Possibly? I'm sorry?
Laura Ingraham, I think?
I don't know if she might have.
Okay.
Steve Dace, who's a really influential radio host in Iowa among conservatives. A lot of these conservative guys were saying, and their rationale, I think, makes sense. What they were saying was, Scalise has to step down, number one, because he shouldn't have been associating with Kenny Knight. And number two, because if this happened to a Tea Partier, the establishment would kick him out in 2 seconds.
That's true.
There's still a lot of raw nerves from the Mississippi Senate race. There are raw nerves from the way Tea Party challengers to Republican candidates get treated. There's raw nerves from the fact that the Tea Party gets called racist all the time. And on the Tea Party, right, there's a sense that this Scalise situation totally reconfirmed that there's a double standard, and that if the establishment wants you in power, you can, you know, pal around with David Duke buddies. But if the establishment doesn't want you in power, then if you speak at a festival where there's a Confederate flag booth, then you're a neo-Confederate and you could never be in any higher office. I don't know that I have a strong opinion on whether or not that double standard exists, but that's the argument Tea Party makes. Tea Party people were very upset. And I talked to Dace, the radio host, yesterday about the efforts to push out Speaker Boehner. And he said the Scalise thing was manna from heaven because Tea Party activists were so upset at this perceived double standard. So, if anything, I think...
Sorry, John Boehner, you just can't win it, man.
Yeah, I know. I know.
Man, I did not see that coming. You know? I mean...
So, it's a really interesting story.
Or maybe now Scalise owes Boehner. I don't know. I mean, like, the dimensions of, like, what's going on, I think, are just too complex and just... We're on counter narratives and counter, you know... slate pitch on slate pitch on slate pitch, if you will.
That's true. Any final thoughts about...
One thing I did really want to ask you, actually, on this, was your piece in particular. There were a lot of interviews of Knight and Duke, but your piece got a lot of traction. It got picked up in Playbook, and a lot of... I didn't see that. Yeah, you did. Good job, buddy.
Cool.
I'll send you the link after. Fist pound. My friend, I'm going to do this. She's going to watch this. So my friend was with some friends over the holidays, and they have two kids, and they learned how to dap. And so they'd be like, dap, blow it up. And they'd be like, again, again. And apparently it was the most adorable thing ever.
That's funny.
So your piece was cited, I think, by some defenders of Scalise as proof that he wasn't there because Knight said he wasn't.
Knight said he wasn't. Right.
Knight said he wasn't. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to take my own analysis here on this in a second and, like, just say that...
Look, Kenny Knight is Kenny Knight. It's up to readers to what they want to make of what he says.
Right, but there wasn't enough... It just doesn't seem like saying Kenny Knight says he wasn't there and Kenny Knight hangs out with David Duke doesn't really... I mean, the fact that he hangs out with David Duke doesn't really confirm or deny anything. But they were definitely saying, case closed on this.
Right.
I wanted to know what your thoughts on that was. I read it very closely, Betsy, and I thought you were very matter-of-fact both ways and just be like, these are the players and that's what they're telling me.
Right.
Woodruff out, you know?
What do I think actually happened?
Were you surprised with the reaction and that particular response by a number of Republican supporters and defenders of Scalise?
No, I wasn't surprised by that response. Mm-hmm. I think that's an understandable response. I think if you buy that interpretation of events that Kenny Knight provided, which is that he spoke at a neighborhood association meeting, I think that's a reasonable interpretation of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the main thing we have to take away from this is that this was a long time ago. And the other thing is that it wasn't just Kenny Knight. It was also his girlfriend, Barbara Nobles, who I spoke to as well, who also attended. So it's two people. I don't think it was important to us that we had two different people telling the same story on that.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that doesn't mean they're both right. That doesn't mean it's gospel. That doesn't mean Steve Scalise is exonerated. But it's interesting. I think you know, the big takeaway to me about that whole situation was that I was just absolutely astonished that Scalise immediately admitted that he was there.
They choked.
That's what surprises me most about this story, is that Scalise immediately said, yep, I was there, based on an internet comment. Look, it's possible he gave the speech. It's possible that Kenny Knight is not a credible person. It's possible he didn't. You know, I mean, Scalise knows. I'd be interesting to see if there are any other eyewitnesses that come forward. You know, you'd think there have to be a number of people who were in the room for that. You heard it?
I mean, one of the things that I think has been interesting is that there's still been coverage of Scalise and stories. My friend who works at CNN sent me a story related to Boehner and Scalise today on this, and that's kind of, I think, what the press should be doing. I mean, one way or another, because it sort of just disappeared with new Congress. Joni Ernst is now a senator today. You know, and it seems like let's continue. Let's get to the bottom of this. When, if he was here or not here, and if he wasn't here, he was exonerated. If he was, he
was. I think what we need is more people who are in the room who can say, "I was there. I heard him give this speech." This either he spoke at the Jefferson Knights of Association or he spoke at the Eurogroup. The fact is, I've talked to two people who were in the room. Steve Scalise was in the room and said he doesn't remember. And then we have an anonymous Stormfront commenter. So, you know, Kenny Knight is David Duke's right-hand man. It's possible he invented the story to try to protect Scalise. Totally possible. It's also possible the story is true. I don't know. I would be very interested in hearing from more people who are in the room. The problem with this is that, like, it takes a lot of time and legwork to find these guys. It's conceivable that someone could go down to Louisiana. And the payoff is conceivably right. Very small. And, you know, even if you find him,
Scalise is staying there. It was years and years ago.
Right. Even assuming the worst case scenario, which is that Scalise actually knowingly addressed this white supremacist group, Scalise is still whip. You know, yeah. Boehner and Scalise were operating under that assumption. Everyone was operating under that assumption when they decided to, you know, not push Scalise to step down. So I'm not sure that the payoff there is that big.
Right.
Which is why I haven't invested a lot of time in trying to find more people who are in the room, you know? But listen, if any blogging head listeners were at the Euro conference in 2002 in Louisiana,
how would you feel about that? I mean, you and I have discussed, we have a big, I'm always surprised when I find who watches us and it's a range from people. I'm just surprised. I'm just going to leave it on that.
Just throw it out there.
I want to touch on one small thing. I mean, not a small thing, a liberal lion, I guess you would say. Cuomo passed away also. Mario Cuomo. This is a big thing. This is a big thing for the Democratic movement or the Democratic Party and liberals, because Cuomo, at the height of Republican ascension decades ago, was the one who was saying no government involvement, and he was this guy who a lot of people wanted to run for president and thought he was their only really serious chance of, you know, ending sort of the Reagan splash and turning things around.
I think of him as kind of progressive as Barry Goldwater, the voice in the wilderness.
So there were a lot of comparisons to him and a lot of sort of like, why didn't he run for president? What would have happened? And maybe he would have been president. Would Bill Clinton have run for president? Would the third way Democrats have risen? And, you know, would that have sort of resulted in the path that we were on? And what was interesting is that I think some reporters I saw who were basically were beat reporters in New York or New York State around that time would say, like, he wasn't a great governor because he at times sort of tussled with the state legislature and didn't always win. But he was a liberal hope in that sense. I don't know. It's a big moment. He didn't run for president. He always toyed around it, and it is. I think he's acknowledged that he got attention for, and it's sort of he tried to use the prospect of running for president to his advantage. And we're going to try and stay away from comparisons to Elizabeth Warren, but there was a piece in National Review liking Cuomo to Elizabeth Warren, and I want to push back on that a little bit here, if I can, Betsy.
Go for it.
Simply because, I mean, Warren is still sort of this one-issue liberal figure, and Cuomo was vast. I mean, he was very much a figure on shaping the entire sort of liberal wing overall. He was a favorite on government involvement in general. Warren right now is still on banking in Wall Street. They've both been mentioned for president, and that's it, you know.
Do you think there are important differences between them?
Cuomo had been around for so long, and Warren is still such a young politician in her career and is still sort of sussing things out and maturing, I guess, in what kind of lawmaker she wants to be. So I think actually the stubborn determination, the sort of like unwavering liberal view, no matter what the landscape is, and the view that they are sort of acting as the liberal weight is the commonality between the two. But other than that, not really. Cuomo, as I understand it, was much more about the social safety net and presence of government and sort of that as a helping hand. And I mean, Warren's into all that, but right now her focus is just like purging the halls of Congress of anyone who's ever set foot on Wall Street or been a banker. So, you know.
Not working out so hot.
Not really, but like, you know, the thing about that is that, and I've heard whispers more and more, is that she's, I mean, her entire crusade is not targeted at Obama. It's targeted at Hillary Clinton to keep the Bob Rubin guys and the people from the 90s banking circle that were in the first Clinton's administration's stuff out of her circle if she were to run for president and win.
Sort of push Hillary to the left?
Yeah, pretty much.
Do you think she's doing a good job at that?
I don't know. We don't know. We really don't know enough about where Hillary Clinton, 2016 Hillary, is on bankers yet. She really hasn't. And
We can kind of guess.
But
I don't think she's had a come to Jesus moment on cleansing her hands of that
Goldman Sachs. No, she wants to win. Yeah, but at the same time, I mean, 90s Clinton was not Obama administration Clinton on gay marriage. So,
well, but that's totally different.
Is it?
Yes.
Why?
Yes, because the gay marriage position changing is absolutely necessary if you're going to be a Democratic presidential contender in 2016. You cannot be a Democrat running for president in 2016 and have the stance that Hillary Clinton had on gay marriage in 2009, 2010.
You can't. It just strikes me, and this is our last topic that I want to segue into.
However,
yep.
I think with banking it's totally different.
I think
totally different. I mean, the gay marriage thing shows that Hillary Clinton's positions can evolve, but closeness with Wall Street, closeness with Wall Street bankers, that money, those alliances are not something that you just kind of quickly evolve out of, no big deal.
Right.
Going from opposing gay marriage to supporting gay marriage has zero political costs for Hillary Clinton. None. Nada. Going from being friendly with Wall Street to not being friendly with Wall Street, a lot tougher. A much harder haul, and also a much more complicated thing to do. You know, those links are much more inextricable than having one position on gay marriage and then not having that position anymore.
I think this is a good moment to segue in. I think you raise a good point, Jeb Bush, and this is important because in the last 48 hours, gay marriage has come up for Jeb a lot.
Yeah.
Actually, gay marriage parts of Florida, all of Florida, I think now is. Or most of Florida, because there are some locales that are just not issuing marriage licenses in protest of the new opportunity, Florida being the new land of gay marriages. Mm-hmm. And the thing about this is that Jeb, who's made a lot of like strides, I mean, he unveiled his political action committee, the Right to Rise PAC.
Extremely unfortunately named.
A terrible name on multiple.
Terrible name.
And there was a lot of snark about it today, by the way, because it was taken apparently from.
It's a line from Lincoln, right?
It's from Lincoln.
Yeah.
You Google it and you see him citing Paul Ryan on this. So the trail is there's a piece in the Wall Street Journal, which I'll make sure we link to at the bottom, that says that. By Jeb that says, you know, Paul Ryan had this great phrase, right to rise.
Oh, no.
Anyway.
Ouch.
Anyway, so.
I wish we had noisemakers for this. Yeah, I wish this was like a radio show with like funny sound effects.
I think the Blogging Heads overlords can incorporate that or like, I don't know, like effects or something like that. We gotta get to this quickly here. Basically, the thing about this is that Jeb was asked on Sunday In a brief interview, which I assume he was playing golf and a reporter ambushed him or something. You know, what do you think about this? And Jeb said, it should be left up to the states, state decision, shouldn't be a court thing, was basically his implication. And the courts, you know, a federal judge rules that gay marriages had to proceed.
And that's the standard Republican position right now.
A day later, he issues a much more polished statement, which basically says we gotta just respect what's going on and, you know, respect different kinds of loves. In a document dump over the holidays, though, there was an employee asking about or looking to work in Jeb's administration, and he said, what about my sexuality? And Jeb basically said in these emails, you know, what you do behind closed doors in your personal time, that's your business. But officially, he's been opposed to gay marriage, but he hasn't, that's not his thing. Like, yeah. He hasn't gone to the
and
mat on
given
it.
Given the chance to discriminate against somebody for being gay, he didn't.
Yeah.
That's to his credit.
Do you think, I mean, the big question is, can he get through a primary? I think he's running. I think he's going to be a strong candidate, despite endless stories these days on all of his problems. And I think what he's doing is really smart, getting his name out there now, building all this stuff now.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think on this, and is he going to evolve on gay marriage?
I think how competitive he is in the primary depends 100% on who else runs. If the other Jeb Bush-esque, you know, establishment Rhino Surrender Caucus guys don't run, for instance, if Rubio doesn't and Romney doesn't, then I think he's a lot more competitive. And he's also a lot more competitive if there's a number of Tea Party and conservative candidates who are competitive as well. I think if the conservative and Tea Party vote is divided, then Jeb Bush has a much easier time shoring up kind of the moderate, normal Republicans.
Right.
One thing that I think is really interesting about how Jeb has sort of proceeded thus far is how much he's used Facebook. He used Facebook to announce that he was officially thinking about, we're moving around. This is
sorry,
fun.
Yeah, we are moving around a little bit. My computer's about
buckle your seatbelts. Right. He used Facebook to announce that he was officially looking at running. He used Facebook to criticize the DNC for the talking points that they'd issued going after him. I think he might have used Facebook to announce Right to Rise, maybe?
Yeah. He did. He used Instagram and Facebook.
Yeah.
It was all the social media platforms.
Yeah, which is interesting because I think it's very smart. In sort of the DC, New York, Acela corridor media bubble, I know at least I tend to have a tendency to think that Twitter is the most important social media outlet. But Facebook has way more users, way, way, way more reach than Twitter does. Much more influential website as far as reaching people who actually vote. People my age use Twitter. People my parents' age use Facebook. So I think it is smart of Jeb to use it. I think it gives him an easy way to directly talk to voters. It's a medium that I think politicians haven't really had in the past.
It's become more powerful.
Definitely
since 2008.
Without a doubt.
And
without
it continues to be very powerful. I think you know as much as
it's
I do from just being a reporter. If something blows up on Facebook, you've just made your paycheck. I mean, was it.
Sarah Palin announced all the people she supported on Facebook, all of her endorsements. Every time she put up an endorsement Facebook post, it made news. So I think a lot of news is going to be made on Facebook. I think it's
all thanks to Mark Zuckerberg wanting to be cool, right?
Absolutely. I think it's going to be really important.
Okay, Betsy. Well, I had to move because my computer is like literally on 1% battery. I think this is a good place to stop. Thank you. You know, it's been a long day for both of us. Thank you, Blogging Heads viewers. We hope you still like us and not Jim and Patrick more. So anyway, I think that's it. See you next time.
See you guys later.